You're listening to The Community Show on 10 Radio with Anton and Pauline. We now have, hopefully on the telephone, an ambassador for the Meningitis Society, Jodie Cross. Good morning, Jodie.
Oh, hello, morning.
It's lovely of you to talk to us from Devon, where you live, and thank you so much for joining us. Now, the Meningitis Awareness Week was at the late September, so what this prompted us to do was get in touch with you to talk about meningitis generally and try and understand a little more about what on earth this terrifying illness is and how on earth we can understand a bit more. Now, Jodie, you're an ambassador for the Meningitis Research Foundation. What made you take on this role?
Well, actually, we're very lucky that all of our family are ambassadors for it. The Meningitis Research Foundation were amazing to us at a time in our lives, which obviously was pretty horrendous. And they've always given us great support, always helped us, and it was a huge honour when they asked us to become ambassadors.
That's quite fantastic. How long have you been an ambassador for the SNEAF Foundation?
I think about 5 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
5 years. So now you have actually gone through so much because you've two daughters and your route into becoming an ambassador and being so passionate about what you do is because of the tragedy of almost losing both your little children, aged 8 months and 3 years old. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what on earth happened?
Yeah, of course. It's a bit of a long story. I've made a few notes. So what happened, you know, our story with meningitis was on October the 23rd in 2003, so nearly 15 years ago, our youngest daughter Millie was 7.5 months old. She'd had quite a bad cough, but she was too young for the doctors to really give her anything for it. So on this particular Friday morning, she was having her morning nap. It was about 10:30 in the morning, but I didn't like the way she was breathing. It was very laboured and shallow, so I picked her up and she was sick, which is really unusual for her. I rang up the doctors and explained I was worried, and they said to go down at 12. They looked at her briefly and said it was just a virus, so I went home. But 2 hours later, I really didn't like the look of her. So I rang the doctors to say, you know, she needs to be seen again. When I carried her in, a nurse quickly got the doctor back in, who injected her in the leg with some antibiotics. They'd already called an ambulance. So the lady doctor said to the ambulance men, get her there as quickly as possible.
Okay.
This was now like 4:30 in the afternoon.
So all day you had been getting worried more and more and more and more worried.
Yes. Yes. Mm. So then they blue lighted us to Bath, because at the time, even though I live in Braunton in North Devon, and I'd lived here most of my life, my husband was in the army, so we obviously moved around.
Mm.
So at the time of this happening, it was in Chippenham. So hence why it's not like the local doctors here. So, we was blue lighted then to Bath, RUH. I was holding Millie in the back of the ambulance with an oxygen mask up to her face. On arrival, I lay her on a bed in A&E, and within maybe sort of 10 seconds, there was about six doctors around her and working on Millie.
Jenny, you must have been completely terrified.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do, which probably doesn't help, that I have this bizarre, my glass is always half full. So, of course, I still never thought that there was anything bad going to happen.
Mm.
Still never thought. But, I can remember that Millie had this really scared look in her eyes. But only then did a slight rash appear. So after a couple of hours, I was told she had septicemia and was very poorly. But a doctor was frantically trying to ring around hospitals for a paediatric intensive care unit for her because all the nearest ones had no beds free. So eventually, there was one at Cardiff University Hospital.
Mm.
It takes a while for the ambulance from Cardiff to get themselves sorted before that they then can come to you.
Yes.
So it probably took them another 2 hours to stabilise Millie and get her ready for the journey. But we was allowed to quickly go in and give her a kiss. Mm. But by now she was so incredibly swollen and wrapped in what they call a bear hug, which looked like bubble wrap. This is to try to keep her arms and legs warm. So we were told to leave first, to not wait for the ambulance. So we got into the car, and then we arrived, obviously, at Cardiff before they did. And that was because Millie had stopped breathing en route, and they'd had to pull over and, resuscitate her. So it probably now is 1 o'clock on the Saturday morning, and again it took another 2 hours until we could go in and see her, and there were so many machines all around her, and obviously she was tiny, she was only 7.5 months old, but she looked massive, she was so swollen. So she had been, she now had multi-organ failure and was on a life support machine.
I mean, the thing about this that staggered me when I read your experience and all of these, this whole journey and so on, was the speed of this illness. Yeah. And obviously the key to dealing with meningitis is speed is of the essence. Because the trouble is, one of the staggering facts that the Foundation makes clear is that half of children with bacterial meningitis are sent home after seeing a GP for the first time because they can't diagnose it, because it's kind of, I suppose, vague and they sent you home, didn't they?
They do, yeah. I mean, that, yeah, totally. The first, and with Lydia, which I'll get to her, they did that several times. But yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, what I'd love is for all GP surgeries to have at least two paediatric trained doctors. Mm. Because quite often they just don't recognise the signs and symptoms. And I always feel that, you know, as parents, you know that there's something wrong, so you take your child, but it's not really your job to diagnose what it is, and you do put your trust in our GPs, but unfortunately, they're general practitioners, they're not specialised, so they're not specialised in paediatrics.
Which is why they're GPs, that's their whole training. And it isn't, as it were, their fault, but it is a terrifying thing. Is the incidence of meningitis in the UK growing?
I'd like to say no, because hopefully people are getting vaccinated. Mm. And obviously the vaccinations are a huge, huge thing. I'm sure the fact is that most teenagers, so it's the ones that are at university, are sort of the bigger carriers. Most of us spread it, have it at the back of our noses and throats, and are fine. But for some reason, which we don't know why, we can pass it on to others. So if anybody who's got any children or any friends or anything whose children are at university, please get them vaccinated, A, so that they don't get the meningitis, obviously, but also it prevents it down the scale from all the others getting it.
Yes, yes. So going back to your little baby, how, I mean, the result of that awful journey to Cardiff and so on was good news?
It was. She did have a lumbar puncture, and it was confirmed that she had pneumococcal meningitis with septicemia. So Millie was given only a 5% chance of survival, but she was actually named Miracle Millie by the doctors. So 2 weeks later, we then came home with her. But then, of course, we come home to our other daughter, Lydia, who was 2¾, and she wasn't very well. So then what happened is, this is now all over a weekend. So she'd been, so Millie's meningitis was obviously her symptom, which shows that they do vary the signs and symptoms of meningitis. So
that's
Millie's was very quick with the laboured breathing once she sort of like flinched at the light a little bit, where Lydia's ended up being more like over a whole weekend. So she, her symptoms were that she was sick, sick and lethargic, she wasn't eating, things like that. So we took her to the doctors, they said it was a virus. Then we took her again the next day, they said it was an ear infection. Then the next day I asked a doctor to do a home visit. Now, I was a little bit old-fashioned that I'd got Millie just out of hospital. I wanted her in the warm for a week before I could take her anywhere. So I obviously didn't want to take Millie out with Lydia to the doctor. So I asked a doctor to come, but he refused, saying there was no need. So eventually, obviously later on the Monday, Tony took Lydia to the doctors. where they called for an ambulance straight away. And ironically, the ambulance drivers that had taken Millie and I were now taking Tony and Lydia.
Good grief, the same crew.
Yeah.
Oh.
To the same Bath hospital. I mean, they just couldn't believe it either.
I'm sure they couldn't.
So, obviously, it took a long time to stabilise Lydia. I mean, she was obviously very, very poorly. And then a rash started to appear on her body. So, again, a big warning to people is don't ever wait for a rash. I mean, with my girls, they were pretty much nearly on life support machines when their rashes started to appear.
Mm.
And the rash really is one of the last things.
Really, with one of the last symptoms, at which point you know, good grief,
are really, really in trouble.
This is it, yes.
So, so Lydia ended up going to Bristol Children's Hospital because luckily they had a bed for her, which was nearer. So at 5 a.m. in the morning, a plastic surgeon went in to see Lydia in intensive care. He warned us that she could be losing her arms, legs, cheeks, tip of her nose and her lips. After 2 hours, he came out of her room to tell us he had to do fasciotomies twice down the back of her legs. This is to prevent her skin from splitting as it was so swollen due to the septicemia.
Mm.
But he measured her arms and would monitor them. But Lydia was so poorly that she was in her own room in the paediatric intensive care unit. And she was on a life support with multi-organ failure and also crush syndrome. So because they couldn't move her to the theatre, they had to scrub out her legs every day in her bed. And after about 2 weeks, Lydia was off the life support. And then she was then moved to the renal ward as they were worried that she might have had to have a new kidney. But 2 days after dialysis, she recovered and she was then moved to a burns unit at French A Hospital. And this is because septicemia basically is like a burn to the skin. So, and she was taken there and they tried desperately to save her legs. But because the soles of Lydia's feet, the skin was so bad, they can't do a skin graft on the soles of your feet.
Mm.
So they said the best thing for her was to have both her legs amputated below the knee. So that happened on the 16th of December, and she had a 7-hour operation to have her legs amputated. But all the time she'd been in hospital, she'd had a feeding tube down her nose. Obviously, she just didn't want to eat. But after her operation, they put her into the high dependency unit. And within half an hour after the operation, she said, I'd like something to eat. And where's Millie? And I want to go to the cafe.
Good grief.
So they went, right, well, there's no point her being in the high dependency unit. She might as well go back to her own room.
Mm.
So then on the 24th of December, we were able to take Lydia home.
On Christmas Eve?
On Christmas Eve.
Oh, my goodness.
So we basically spent like 2 months in hospital with both girls with different strains of meningitis because Lydia had HIB, Haemophilus influenza type B with septicemia.
Julie, your story is amazing, and thank God both girls survived, albeit that Lydia's had the amputation, but she is coping now, I know, because you've, on your wonderful blog on the website, there's a lovely set of comments about how she's coped with her little leggies.
Yeah.
And they're fine now, but what this does bring up is, for God's sake, take note of symptoms. Now, you as an ambassador for the foundation are obviously incredibly well placed to talk to other people, to make them aware of the dangers of not observing symptoms in their children and encouraging everyone to get vaccinated. How do you do that? Do you go around and talk to groups or what?
Yeah, I have done that. I've gone to, like, baby clinics. I've gone to schools. We've done evenings where people have come and listened to our story. I mean, I'm really shocked that 15 years after this has happened, that we're still having to do this.
Mm.
You know, we wish there could be a magic wand that there was never another person that suffered. Because obviously it's children that tend to get it. Also adults, it's not, you know, anybody can get it.
Yes.
But I just, you know, every time you hear of another case, it brings it all back, and you're just feeling it for the parents, you know, or the are going through it, you know, just knowing what they're going through. I mean, we are extremely lucky. We've got both our girls. Liz does amazing. She's an art student, can drive just an ordinary automatic car. She's got a great life, great family, great friends, you know, fantastic sense of humour. Millie has got empathy and kindness coming out of the bucket loads because she's obviously looked after Lydia with us all.
Mm.
But, yeah, you just, you know, there's lots that lose their children, and lots that are left with far, far worse disabilities. All parts of them amputated, all their arms, all their legs, left with brain damage. You know, we are extremely lucky.
You are, when you're telling me of these symptoms. I mean, clearly this is a complete killer, this horrible, horrible disease. And and the thing, as I have said, is the speed at which it can literally take over.
Yeah.
You know, within hours.
Yeah, totally.
So the key is to react to symptoms when...
Yeah.
When you're worried, don't think, oh, I can't bother the doctor, or I shouldn't be phoning again, or whatever.
Yeah.
Especially with smaller children. But then, as you say, with, you know, college and university-aged young people also.
Yeah, because they think it's the thresher's flu.
Mm.
So, and you can imagine they're out having a great time and they've been partying, so they feel a bit run down.
Mm.
And then people probably think, oh, they've laid in because they're a bit hungover. But you need to check on your mates. You know, knock on the door and make sure that they are all right.
Mm.
Yeah, I'd say to everybody, go by your gut instincts.
Mm.
You know, and fight. Unfortunately, because I was so trusting, Lydia has suffered the consequences of me having this always half, you know, glass always half full, because I'm always like it and always still will be. But I really trusted them.
Well,
so, you know.
I think in a way, by having that glass half full, it means that you've been able to cope with this double tragedy, both of which have turned out well in the end, thrown at you in such an intensely short period of time on two tiny children. I mean, it just isn't fair.
I know. They did say that it was a 1 in 8 million chance that they could have got two unrelated meningitises. They didn't even catch it from each other.
I mean, that's the bizarre thing, isn't it? And do the medical people have any idea how that could have possibly happened?
No. Initially, they wondered whether it was a hereditary immune deficiency, or if they didn't have spleens, if that could have done it. But no, it was just one of those things.
That's really, really strange, isn't it? Because, well, it's not strange, it's just horribly ironic, two different strains. You would have kind of perhaps been more expecting it to be the same strain.
Yeah, totally. Mm. Yeah, but no.
Yes.
Very individual.
Yes. Yeah. So the Meningitis Foundation, Research Foundation, has to obviously keep raising money and awareness of the terrifying results of this illness and of not paying attention to it immediately. So you as an ambassador are helping with that. The Awareness Week is part of that as well, and you are, you know, you are obviously part of that and talking to groups.
Yeah.
What's the next stage? What are you doing in your local area to spread the word?
Yeah, we did. We did do a local interview for ITV West Country, and we did that quite often. What we do as well is we go to places where other families that have been affected with meningitis, they go, and you see other families. But it always quite humbles both my girls, because it humbles Millie, because she feels like she got away with it lightly. And then obviously Lydia feels she has too, because she only lost the bottom of her legs, where there's children there that have obviously lost more. But what's quite good with these sort of open days that they do is that Lydia will go on a panel with other sort of teenagers or slightly older than that, And then parents can ask Lydia things, you know, like, how did she cope? How's she getting on with the prosthetics? You know, things like that. The one thing I think, though, that we wasn't warned after Lydia's amputations, because obviously we thought, right, okay, let's do this, and then she can just carry on with her life. We wasn't warned that Lydia, unfortunately, has had to have bone trimming operations nearly every year, and then they have to refashion her padding. So, like, that's excruciating for her. She's got the most amazing surgeon now at the Children's Hospital, who's always amazing with her, Fergal Monsell. But it means that she can't wear her prosthetics for a while, so she's, like, stuck at home and all that sort of stuff.
But that'll be the next fascinating journey in your lives. I mean, that's to come. The learning about new legs and all of those things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we've had to go all through that, of course.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Jodie, I'm stunned by your resilience and your reaction to this double whammy that hit your family. But it's so good to know that the girls came through it with you and your husband's support and so on. Well done, and thank you so much for talking to us today on Ten Radio. It's been lovely to hear you, and keep up the amazingly good work.
Oh, thank you so much. And yeah, please, everybody, get your children vaccinated, yeah. Or make sure you do get your friends and everybody. And any questions, obviously get in touch with the Meningitis Research Foundation.
That's the key. Get your children vaccinated. Jodie, thank you so much indeed. And now we're going to hear some very appropriate music, and I think Anton's going to tell us what we shall hear.
Thank you.
Jodie, good morning to you. I must say our hearts, and I'm sure the hearts of all our listeners, really do go out to you and to Amelia and Lydia. That's the most unbelievable story, and your strength and fortitude is just something else we should all take an example from. So thank you so much for speaking with us today. You've chosen a piece of music, Christina Aguilera. Tell us why.
Yeah, this is, as I try to be obviously always very positive, though, this song always makes me quite emotional, because it used to make me think about Lydia when she was younger, and maybe that people might be a bit cruel to her, but to me and to others, she'll always be beautiful no matter what.
Thank you again, Jodie.
Thank you.
The community of the Ten Parishes and Wyvil Iscombe have a very varied mix of events, concerts, club meetings, embracing all manner of subjects. As the voice of the community, we at Ten Radio try to tell you what is going on, but we also like to give everyone the opportunity to share, discuss and talk about their views on matters that affect the community. Join me, Pauline Holmshaw, for the Community Show live every Friday morning at 9 a.m. until noon, and repeated from 4 p.m. on Mondays to hear what concerns are being discussed and how the community is handling them. That's the Community Show live every Friday morning at 9 a.m.